Welcome to the podcast Hantverksbira. This week we celebrate the 20th anniversary of Innis & Gunn, maybe the most famous craft brewery in Scotland and known worldwide. In episode 72 of podcast Hantverksbira, we have the founder of Innis & Gunn, Dougal Sharp, on the show. We talk about the history of the brewery, how everything started and evolved, and of course also the future. Feel free to follow Hantverksbira on Instagram for reporting about craft beer. Enjoy this episode and remember, we love feedback. Cheers.
So I just want to give you the context of it all, because I've been doing beer for so long now, it's kind of all I know. So I started, Dad bought, he did a management buyout of a brewery in Edinburgh called Caledonian. Well, it was actually called Lorimer and Clark's Brewery in Edinburgh, but way back in 1987. And this beer business was producing beer for working men's clubs in the north of England. So these were miners, steel workers, you know, after work they would go to these clubs and drink copious quantities of the beer that we were producing in this little brewery in Edinburgh. And it was all quite low strength, like 3.6% alcohol, draft beer. But the brewery that owned the brewery we bought had decided to shut it and transfer manufacturing down to England. So in a moment of madness, actually inspired by Mum, Dad got together a group of investors and bought this brewery. And because it had been making beer for England, it had no local business whatsoever. So the Lorimer brand was totally unknown in Edinburgh. The brewery didn't come with a supply agreement for these clubs in England. So we started with this, I think it was like 300,000 hectolitre brewery with no business whatsoever. And of course, they were absolutely penniless. They had no money, you know. So I was at age 14, available, begrudgingly available £1 an hour to come in and work, to do all the shit that nobody else wanted to do. So I was given all the worst jobs, and it was weekends from school and my school holidays. And that's kind of the way it went. As we built that business up, or as Dad built it up with his team, I was kind of there in the background doing all the stuff that, you know, nobody else really wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And as I went through school, that continued. And then I went through uni, that continued. One of the benefits was that I was learning everything that you can do in a brewery. Like, I did literally every job you can actually do in a brewery. And you know, kind of half enjoyed it. You know, I was always envious of my mates when they were all fucking away to Ibiza shagging and I was working in a brewery. But there you go. You know, I kept learning, kept honing my skills. And kind of, you know, by the time I'd graduated from uni, I'd done everything, including going out in the lorries, delivering beer and actually standing in the brew house, physically making products. So I graduated from uni, and the day that I graduated, the brewery burned down.
Okay.
It was, I mean, the thing had been, it was an old Victorian brewery, had been built in 1869, right? And it had this old, you know, original old maltings.
Yeah. Did it burn down to the ground or just parts of it?
Part of it. So the maltings building burnt down and part of the brew house went. And all the malt handling, because the original malt silos were all made of wood, flat bottom wooden malt silos. So that was a problem. So I'll never forget, actually, Dad rung me up and said, look, I know you've been planning to go and do something different when you graduated, but would you mind coming in and helping with the rebuild? Because we're going to rebuild. They kept going by hook or by crook. They kept manufacturing going. Can you come in and help me rebuild it? And I said, yeah, of course. No problem. So I put the thing I was going to do on hold.
And but your plan when you sort of graduated from university was not to go back to the brewing business, to do something completely different. So that was sort of a coincidence that you actually was sort of, that happened in the same time where you were sort of finding out what you want to do with the rest of your life.
Yeah. I was going to do a master's in environmental chemistry. And that was kind of the route I was going down. I was going to do something totally different to this. Mm-hmm. But my first full-time job out of university was to rebuild this Victorian brewery like it used to look on the outside, but modernize it on the inside. So a great professional challenge, not a pretty steep learning curve for a graduate, but I really relished the opportunity. And of course, I'd been working in the brewery by that point for 7 years.
Yeah.
So I kind of had, like, I knew all how it worked and I knew how all the different bits fitted together. So it gave me a unique insight. So I was able to do that. And then Dad kind of got me into brewing. He gave me the brewing file one day. It was a sort of brown manila envelope. And he handed it to me and said, look, why don't you get into the brewing theory a bit? So I sort of hit the books and sort of started to learn. And the one thing that struck me was it was all written down in note form. And, you know, there was no consistency in anything. And I suppose having a science background, you know, I always look for patterns and consistencies. And there was none in our brewing approach. So I got sent to Timothy Taylor's brewery in Keighley, a brewery that I still love and greatly respect. I love the products and I love their approach. And so I did a pupillage there and really it opened my eyes to what you can do with beer and brewing and materials particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And how you source and how important provenance is and all of this stuff. And so I came back to Caledonian then with a really different viewpoint on quality and product and how to make beer and how to source the ingredients and then kind of set about transforming things there from where it had been, which was a little bit, it was good, but it was disjointed, shall we say. And I brought real purchasing rigor to our raw materials and process rigor to the manufacturing side of things. And although we'd won a lot of prizes up until we started making these changes, once we started to really get into the background of making beer there, we started to really clear up. You know, we won everything that you could win. It took me years to win Champion Beer of Britain, but we did finally in 2002. But you know, through that time, you know, from joining full time in 1994 through the late 90s, we just kept serially improving what we were doing and building up that sort of reputation for quality, and I love it. It was a huge learning experience, a great privilege to do something like that in a supportive environment like Caledonia was, and it was successful, you know.
But it was still the original British styles of beer.
Yeah, it was a cask ale, you know. It was a 3.8% IPA in cask, so you know, with the live yeast in the cask.
Yeah.
And if you get that right, I still think it is one of the best expressions of beer. If you get cask ale absolutely dead right in terms of the manufacturing aspect of it and the serving and the pub aspect, I don't think there is much better a beer experience. And it's a unique experience to the British Isles. I know other places try it. You know, I've seen it in Sweden, I've seen it in Canada and places around the world, but you don't really get it in the same way that we do. Because it's just sort of deeply ingrained in our culture, in our beer cultural history.
Yeah.
I still love Timothy Taylor. I still drink pints of that stuff on cask wherever I find it, you know. Because I absolutely love it. Anyway, we kept on growing and we kept on, you know, inventing and finally we won, as I say, we won Champion Beer of Britain in 2002. First Scottish beer business ever to do that. I think I was the youngest brewer to have won it at the time. So it was the beginnings of a bit of a shake-up on the scene. And obviously the core product there continued to grow from you know, many years after I left because of the sort of solid foundations that had been laid. But in 2002, so coming on to Innocent Gun, all of that learning about flavor and quality and provenance and all of these things kind of played into what came next, because, you know, we were working very hard to make, you know, or to deliver to the consumer an exciting and compelling beer experience, right? We were doing everything we could, because I wanted, you know, somebody standing in the bar having a pint of any of our beers to taste it and go, I'm having a second pint, the minute you'd had your first sip. That to me is the sign of a great beer, is when you have it, you're a third of the glass down and you're going, I'm having another one of these. There's no doubt about that. That's what I look for, right? So we were doing all this sort of work behind the scenes to make the product amazing. But what always struck me about the whole, and it was the same for us as it was for the whole of the rest of the British beer scene, the way that we were then talking to consumers about the products, either through the packaging, the labels on the bottles or the cans, or the advertising, the way that these, you know, the bigger brands would communicate through outdoor advertising and things like that, it just all seemed so run down and thoughtless, and you were never building any appeal into the products. If you think about all the craftsmanship that goes in behind the scenes, and then the label just looks boring. And it doesn't really tell you anything about all of the shit that the people that make it have gone through, you know, to make it. And you know, not everyone's interested in that, but some people are.
Yeah.
And you know, craftsmanship should never be undervalued, I don't think. So I got really quite frustrated at the sort of state of the industry and, you know, to an extent with what we were doing at Cali. Because I thought, we could be so much more communicative and premium in our approach to the sort of marketing aspects of what we were doing. And coincidental to that, we had been working with this big global distilling company called William Grant & Sons on, they wanted to see if they could season a whiskey barrel with beer flavor. And I was interested in what beer flavor you'd get out of a whiskey barrel if you put beer in it. So there was this sort of collaboration between these two, our business and their business, to experiment with beer styles and whiskey barrels just to see what happened.
Was that sort of a joint idea that sort of sparked, or did they actually approach you first to say that we want to try this out?
Yeah, they approached us, and then obviously, you know, when we got chatting, the idea sort of very quickly came up, well, you know, let's try a range of beer styles, and let's try a range of whiskey, you know, or different casks that you've got in your inventory, and let's just see what happens. So we did that, and, you know, one of the beer styles that we matured was this sort of Edinburgh strong ale in a whiskey cask. And of course, a lot of whiskey casks, well, most whiskey casks are bourbons, right? So they've had bourbon in them. Then they've maybe had a scotch or a grain or whatever in them for a bit. And so we'd fill the strong ale into one of these casks. And we emptied it out, sent them the cask back so they could do their experiments, and we tasted the beer, and I kid you not, it was like being hit by a bolt of lightning. And I thought, fucking hell, I have never tasted anything like this before.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously being in the industry for as long as I had, even at that point, you've tried most stuff, right? You know the styles, you know the different brewers, you know the products, and you've tried it all, right? And I thought, holy shit, there's nothing, I've never tried anything like this before.
So, and then you said you had, like, that was sort of pure bourbon casks they were just putting strong ale on. So what kind of beer did you use then?
It was, I mean, the product was called Edinburgh Strong Ale. That was the beer that we were using. So, and I mean, I put the product under various people's noses and said, well, what do you think of this? And try it. And people were absolutely bowled over. And then we had a rugby international in Edinburgh, and we'd invited, and we were doing hospitality, and we invited the buyers from Safeway, which is no longer in the UK. It was bought by Morrison's, big supermarket chain, and I think Sainsbury. So we had the beer buyers from both of those groups in our sample cellar. And I said to them on the quiet, I said, look, I've got this product that we've been experimenting with. And I told them a little bit about the background. I said, do you want to just give it a try it? Have a wee taste. And so they tasted it and they both said, well, I'll tell you something. If you can put this in a bottle and it tastes this good, yeah, we will put it in all of our stores immediately. And I was like, that, right, okay then. That sounds good. So, I mean, obviously, that was great news in a sense, but there's a lot of work between the discovery and buyers saying, yeah, look, we're interested in this, to actually turning that into a product. And yeah, unbelievably, I spoke to the sales director at the time at Caledonian, and he just wasn't interested.
Okay.
Just couldn't see it. Hmm. And to be fair, you know, we did have, you know, our core brand at the time there was very successful and growing, so it would have been a distraction, so fair enough.
Yeah, and you had just won sort of the award for that beer and that product.
We hadn't we hadn't at that point.
Okay.
But we had won, we'd won one other big industry prize at that point, which is like, you know, the sort of more the industry side of it, and then the GB, the Champion Beer of Britain, is more the consumer side. So we were on track, but we hadn't won the Champion Beer yet. Okay.
Yeah. But the idea of the brewery was to be like more traditional, and what you came and presented was more like a experimental approach.
Yeah.
So do you think they were not really prepared to sort of reshift their focus, and they wanted to sort of go more with a traditional focus, because that's what I've invested over many years and tried to achieve, like a position in the market for traditional, like Scottish British beers.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, and obviously I was sort of undeterred by that. So I said to Grant, look, I think we've got something here. Why don't we do something together?
Mm-hmm.
Because by that point I'd started to, you know, thinking back to what I'd said earlier on about, you know, the way that our industry was communicating products to consumers. I had started to look at the way that the spirits guys were doing it and recognize the incredible skill and talent that they have in packaging design, brand communication, you know, all of the things that actually brings to the fore the craftsmanship that sits behind products.
Hmm.
So I thought this, you know, these guys could be a natural partner for this venture. So I spoke to Grants and they were interested. They said, yeah, let's do it. So I left the family company with Dad's blessing. He said, no, totally understand. You know, he was the managing director. He didn't want to cut across the sales director and sort of cause big internal battle. So he just said, well, look, with my blessing, you go and do it. Just go and do it. So I did. We set the company up in 2002. It took me about 12 months to come up with. So I left in June 2002. It took 12 months to come up with the process to sort of commercialize how to manufacture Innocent Gun original as the product became, in that sort of, in the quantities required for a launch, because obviously you have to put everything in a, but back then everything into a barrel. And then we launched it in 2003. We also then did all the sort of brand design. So we came up with packaging, which is, you know, even to this day, it's a feature of our brand. We have this very distinctive, iconic packaging.
Yeah.
And that all kind of harks back to that moment in time and that frustration that I felt. And obviously we came up with the name and stuff like that, Innocent Gun. It's the middle names of me and my brother.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at, you know, where we were back in 2003 when we launched Innocent Gun to the UK, you know, all beer was in a brown bottle. All beer label shapes were roughly the same. They all said the same things, you know, the product name, the ABV, you know, brewed with choicest malt and hops, you know, for a smooth, tasty finish. You know, that was the extent, the way that consumers were being lured into products. And you know, we launched a smaller clear glass bottle, four labels on it, you know, really signatures, hand signed, telling the story of the product. Launched it into the supermarkets and it just took off straight away. Because it was so radically different to everything else in the marketplace from both a packaging perspective and a product perspective.
But you still managed to convince the conservative customer to buy your products anyway.
Well, you know, if you think about it, £1.70, which it was when we launched it, it's not that much money.
No, no.
You know, and you know, what we do know about male shoppers in supermarkets, as it is here, is they do like to browse the beer aisle and sort of pick things up to try. So, you know, it was, I think, you know, getting early traction proved reasonably easy, you know, and then obviously as the business developed, we became more commercially savvy, but then we're able to do different things to help that develop. But and so that's kind of really the sort of story of how Innocent Gun came about. And, you know, now 20 years down the road, it's clear that I think what I was frustrated with was a lack of originality. And it's the thing now which absolutely singularly defines our brand and what it stands for. We're a brand that is all about originality and doing it your own way and being comfortable to just have the courage of your convictions to do it the way that you think is right and not to be overly influenced by, you know, other factors in the industry as it is for us, you know, and that's held true now to this day. You know, everything we do, we've launched other products subsequently that have gone on to be very big commercial successes because we don't copy other people. And I think the industry is rife with copycats, you know. You know, one IPA launches in one way and, you know, everyone else is copying it, you know, and that's just not for me. It's not my bag. It's not what made this company what it is today. It's doing our own thing and doing it as best we can, I think, is where, you know, we're at our strongest. And that, I hope, comes through in the way that we communicate. You know, we're trying to appeal to those people who, like me, you know, see that, you know, originality is a good thing and that want to, you know, have their own set of rules to an extent, define their own way through life rather than be sort of guided like a sheep.
Yeah.
So, you know, that really is what our brand is all about. But it all stems back to that sort of sense of frustration that I felt, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s.
How do you think that Sweden became that such an quite large export market for you? Because I mean, the people in Sweden, we are being influenced quite a lot with the foreign stuff. And I mean, you're new stuff, but also you do it your own way.
I think the Swedish, I've always found Swedish drinkers. You know, of all the places I've been around the world, they are some of the most appreciative of the craft that sits behind products, and they're the most interested in it. So, again, when I started to come out to Sweden, I felt like, God, this is like a mecca here, because, you know, there's people that are actually interested in the stuff I'm interested in, you know, probably more so than they were in the UK. And that was great. You know, it's a great opportunity to talk to people and say, you know, this is how we do it. And by God, you've got a lot of questions. Whenever I go to beer festivals, oh my God, you know, the questions are unbelievable. But I love it, and it's a privilege to be asked them, because it tells me that the consumer is interested. And I, you know, for a guy that makes beer for a living, and has done for over 30 years, that's bloody brilliant. I love it. And so we launched early in Sweden, and obviously, you know, you're a big single malt whiskey market too. So I think the consumer, you know, the drinkers there kind of got where we were coming from, because we looked a little bit like a single malt whiskey cask or a single malt whiskey bottle. We used some of the same language, and, you know, we were sort of demonstrating a different way of thinking on our product. And you know, the Swedish drinker really quickly took to that. Hmm. But I think there is a high level of appreciation, you know, because booze is expensive in Sweden.
Yeah.
You know, so I think people do genuinely appreciate it and want to know as much as they can about it. And I think that's good for products like Innocent Gun.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look back in the beginning of 2000 in Sweden, I mean, we still have the monopoly around here. So, and back then, I mean, the availability of different kinds of beers around the world was limited. Mm-hmm. So there was mainly lager, maybe some British ales. You have some German Pilsners and maybe Weiss beers, but there was not that much thing to explore. And then, I mean, you came along 2004, 2005, something like that in Sweden.
Yeah.
I think there was a big interest in exploring new kind of flavors, new type of drinks and new styles of beers here. And after that, I mean, there was a huge boom here for craft brewing, and a lot of things got imported through Systembolaget. Mm-hmm. And nowadays we have a lot of tons of influences for all over the world. But back then when you started out, I think it was quite limited in what you could actually pursue. And also, as you said, I think another important part of it was that in the late 90s, there was sort of a single malt whiskey boom going on here. There's a lot of people that got interested in single malt whiskeys, and that sort of moved over to beginning 2000s as well. And then when you come along with a product that was first of all like a different kind of beers, and then was barrel aged on whiskey casks, that sort of married those two interest spheres and also sparked additional interests. At least that's what I think. And that's sort of what got me into it as well. And Victor and I discussed this a little bit. So I think we tried it out quite early, like 2005 maybe.
Yeah.
And we think it was the original back then. And it's one of those moments, you know, sometimes you have drink beers where you sort of recall it afterwards, that it was sort of a changer in one way or another. And I can definitely say that the original was a changer for us back then, well, as well really as the rum cask version that came a couple of years later, that you sort of still have memories that you can tie back to. And that's normally because, I mean, there's something new and new experience connected with the beer. And both of us had those kind of experiences in the middle of 2000, which is very interesting and fun.
Well, it's lovely of you to say, and I really appreciate it. And but I'm not surprised, because I had exactly the same thing. Hmm. You know, when I tasted out of the barrel that very first time, I had exactly the same moment. I was like, oh, right. Yeah. Oh, wow. God, this is different. And actually, you know, it's a funny one, because the first time you taste it, if you hadn't, and certainly back then, you know, no one was doing anything like this. So it actually, the first few sips, it took me a while for my brain to actually work out what was going on, because it was beer, but it didn't taste like normal beer. It had this whole different depth of flavor and umami sort of taste, and there's just so much going on, and it takes you probably half a glass to go, ah, right, now I get it. And then suddenly you go, bloody hell, it's good. And then you can, then you begin to work out when you drink it, what occasions it's for and stuff like that. So yeah, I had exactly the same experience. Yeah. And I feel very lucky to have had that. Because, you know, most things have been tried before, you know, one way or another.
I mean, it would be harder and harder to get that. I mean, today the beer market is so vast. There's so much impressions, and everyone just trying to trump each other on more flavor, more hops, more flavor, more whatever, more alcohol, everything. So today, I mean, to be a balanced beer that takes out the natural flavors of the ingredients and the way that you build it or brew it is something to honor today, I would say.
Well, thank you. And I think you're right. I mean, look, you know, we're not trying to out-hop anyone here. That's not our thing. You know, there are lots of great brewers out there that are queuing up to chuck too many hops in a fermenter. That's just not our thing. You know, we are good. We're really, you know, over 20 years, we've developed all sorts of proprietary technology to make our barrel aged, our whiskey cask matured beers at the scale that we now do. You know, we still put beer in barrel, obviously, but we have other techniques that, you know, are pretty well publicized. And you know, we've developed, you know, singular focus on delivering an outstanding flavor experience to drinkers. It's not going to change, and we're not trying to outdo anybody on anything. We're just doing our own things.
And as you said, the flavor experience. If you look at your bottles today, and also how you describe product, I mean, you used a different language back then, and how to describe flavors in beer. So was that sort of influences coming from, as you said, the wine and spirits industry?
Definitely, yeah. Because we were certainly weren't using it, you know, in the beer industry. There was just none of that, and I thought that we could do better. And I think it's important to at least, whether visually you're signposting to the consumer what to expect, or you tell them in words, you know, you've got to give them a bit of a clue. Otherwise,
You build up a narrative around the product that is a little bit more luxurious or premium in the way you express. And also, I mean, as you said, you tell the customers a little bit about the product, and also help them a little bit on the journey that you first experienced, where you had sort of spun around because it was not something you normally tasted. Yeah. But having that description can also maybe make it easier for you to accept it, so to speak, and understand the beer quicker.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I mean, it's always, you know, we're only trying to help, you know, because we know we've got a good product in the bottle or the can. The question is, how do we help the consumer to get to reach that same conclusion? And, you know, the only way they'll do that is by trying it.
So if we move back to when you sort of experienced this new invention, and you cut the bounds with the existing brewery and started to work with Grants to develop this product, but you were out of a brewery. So how do you get the beer into the barrels back then?
Well, this is the great thing. I said to the company I left, look, would you continue to, you brew this, here's the recipe, you brew this for me, I'll pick it up in a road tanker, we'll take it across to the distillery and we'll mature it. So that was the way we made it. You know, I had limited startup capital when I launched Innocent Gun. The last thing I wanted to do was spend it building a brewery, because I just spent the last, 10 years full-time working in a brewery, and I knew the pitfalls, the costs. You know, I'd had to rebuild it after a major fire. For a startup business, it's just not the right thing. You know, or at least it wasn't in my opinion, when I knew I could get what I needed, exactly the product that I needed, out of a brewery that I'd just run for 10 years. So that's what I did. I focused on building the brand rather than the brewery. And that was a successful strategy. Now, not everyone liked that, you know. The purists out there, particularly when craft came along, would sort of criticize that strategy and say, "Well, you're not a real craft brewer." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not trying to be a fucking craft brewer. We're just doing our own thing here. Mm-hmm. If you don't like it, don't drink the product."
But today you have a terminology for that. It's there's a lot of ghost brewers today that sort of. Yeah. Rent capacity at different brewers and then develop their own recipes and still do their own product. They don't just own the equipment very much. So, I mean, then you pretty much did the same thing back then.
I mean, I always thought it was a spurious argument about, you know, whether or not craft brewing, you know, or contract is, you know, contract manufacturing, contract brewing is right or wrong. It's up to the bloody brewer, you know, it's my business. And that was what was right for me, because I knew I could get what I needed from a quality perspective. But actually, if you look at where we are now, I mean, we're manufacturing 80% of Innocent Gun in a 4 million hectolitre lager brewery. Does it affect or lessen the quality of what we make? Absolutely not. It actually helps improve it. Because you've got all the quality systems, all of the quality people, the processes, all of the systems that sit around that. It's our materials. I pick everything. So I know exactly what goes in. I know exactly what I can get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, I don't have to own that brewery to get that. And again, I've been quite single-minded about that. Now, I've got planning permission to build a brewery in Edinburgh, and it is part of the plan at some point. Certainly, you know, with current situation in Ukraine and the last few years of the pandemic, now is not the time to be building a brewery. Because you'll be well aware of inflation and all of these things causing all sorts of problems for consumers, for businesses. So now is not the time to be building it. But, you know, as soon as the business is in a position to build that brewery in Edinburgh, we'll build it. But, you know, first priority is continue to build the brand.
Yeah.
And make sure that, you know, we are delivering outstanding consumer experiences every time you open a bottle or a can of our product. And what we're doing at the moment seems to work.
Do you think it's been it's becoming more harder to expand your brand now that the brewery industry are so like over established of brewers, more or less?
It's a funny one. I mean, I think certainly the noise of the craft beer explosion, I think it distracted a lot of players in the industry. We were one of them. You know, we were definitely distracted by it. But I think a lot of companies were, but we quickly realized that actually focusing on what we do best is the right thing for this business. So we've not kind of followed these IPA businesses into the sort of bun fight of different IPA hop styles and hazies and all that sort of stuff. It's just not our thing. And I think now the consumer is beginning to tire of that constant churn of new products, new ideas. Because let's face it, they're not really. They all kind of taste broadly the same. You know, there are very few times now where you have a craft beer and you go, you know, or a craft IPA and you go, bloody hell, that's totally different to the last one I tried. They're all in such a narrow bandwidth. Actually, it's almost like it's become a parody of itself. Yeah.
For me and Victor, I mean, over the years we tried, I mean, a lot of different kinds of craft beers. But one thing that sort of has struck us the last couple of years is that you're getting more into like the well balanced, more a little bit more traditional beers that are very good at doing the thing they have always done, and you appreciate that more and more as well. I mean, it could be fun with all these explosions to left and right. But it is, as you say, the magic goes away after a while. And then you end up with the interest of beer and beer craft and beer making. And that's the thing that sort of preserves and goes with you. And getting a well-balanced beer that sort of brings out the pure flavor of the ingredients and the process. That's, at least for me, is the pure craftsmanship in this business.
Well, you got to remember that, you know, people drink, you know, beer is a volume drink.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's the right or the wrong thing to say or to admit to. But I mean, beer is people like to drink multiple serves of beer. That for whatever reason, that's the way that the human being is set up. Right. I'm not commenting on whether that's right or wrong, but that is my 30 plus year observation of people drinking beer, right, is that if you're a beer drinker, you like to have multiple beers, obviously in a responsible way, but
of course.
But the thing is, you can't drink multiple 9% double hopped IPAs. You just can't.
No,
you can barely drink one, right? And most people, I think, and you can see this in the craft stats in the UK now. I'm not close enough to what's happening in Sweden currently, but there's definitely a sort of, you know, resurgence of, well, in the UK it's premium lager, you know, so that's kind of the next big thing here.
Yeah,
it's premium and world lagers, and of which Innocent Gun Lager is one of the leading products in the Scottish marketplace. Because you can sit down and it's got plenty of flavour. It's looks great in the glass, you know, it's well supported, but you know, the key and all the sort of health metrics and stuff that you would expect a brand like us to deliver in terms of, you know, outlet support and, you know, branding and whatever. But the point is, you can have a few, you know, you can have a few pints of innocent gun lager. That's what folk want from beer. There is a small subsection of super connoisseurs that want something new and different every time. But I wouldn't say that that is everyone. And it's really, it's the mass market I'm trying to appeal to here. With our lager, with original, you know, with Innocent Gun original and Caribbean rum cask, Irish whiskey cask, that there's just an occasion for them. You know, I'm not trying to, you won't have 10 bottles of that. You never will. It's too strong. The point, it's a strong beer that you have in a nice, relaxed occasion, you know, on a Thursday night after work. It's nearly the weekend. You have a couple of bottles there with dinner. Yeah. Or when you're cooking Sunday dinner or Sunday lunch, you have a couple of bottles of original. It's that, that's the type of product it is. It's not down the pub drinking, you know, but so they're my occasions. They're the occasions I want to own. And, you know, craft owns different occasions to that, you know, especially these super hoppy IPAs. But I think increasingly now the consumer's kind of drifting back to slightly more accessible, more mainstream. You know, that doesn't, I think, necessarily now mean bland or boring. That's the one huge gift that craft beer has given, is the opportunity to do things differently, but to express them differently to the consumer.
So, and I mean, we can see it in Gothenburg. I mean, it started to pop up at least one, maybe two bars and pubs that only have Pilsner, yeah. Nothing else. So it's definitely going in that direction, as it says.
And the Belgians, you know, if you look at the big, you know, some of the more classic, you know, speciality beer styles that are having a resurgence now around the world, I think is part of the same symptom. That, you know, there's a sort of recognition that there are other styles, and actually picking up a bottle of Innocent Gun or a bottle of Pam or whoever, a bottle of Leff or Hogarden or Duvel or what. I mean, these products, they're consistent. You know exactly what you're getting. You know the occasion. You're never going to be disappointed by them. You know, you're never going to pour half of one away. You know, and I think there's something in that.
So now you are approaching 20 years, and I guess you have your philosophy that should last for at least 20 more years.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, let's hope so.
I mean, I tell you, you know, it's a funny thing, you know, even talking about being 20 years old as a business, I can't actually believe it.
No.
I genuinely can't believe it, because I still feel like I've only just scratched the surface. I still feel really lucky. You know, every day, you know, whether it's the products we make or the people that work in the business that work with me, I just feel like a great sense of privilege and thankfulness that I've been given an opportunity to do something like this. I still love it. I still love coming to work.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm really excited to share this, you know, this 20th anniversary product, which we've matured in these 20-year-old single malt whiskey casks, with, you know, with the world, and you know, we just keep going. You know, every year we're doing bigger and more exciting things in the business now as we build momentum out, particularly out of the pandemic and out of this sort of crisis that's been caused by the war in Ukraine, and it just fills me with more and more excitement. So I just I'm loving it. We're very lucky, and I hope, you know, I hope for any of your audience, you know, that are still enjoying that, or you know, maybe you've been enjoying Innocent Gun for 20 years or however long, you know, you've known it, 15 years, or you're new to it and you've never tried it. Give it a go, and thank you for anyone that has gotten into it and tried it and enjoyed it, and because you know, I mean, together, that's what makes the brand. And as I say, when I come out to Sweden, I meet people all the time and they show me their photographs of their collections. They've got every single limited edition we've ever made in a cabinet at home. And I'm like, oh my God, thank you so much. It's incredible. You can't believe it. You cannot believe that this sort of stuff goes on. So yeah, I'm always sort of surprised and delighted by the reaction I get when I come out to Sweden about our brand and about our product.
Yeah, we seem to have you seem to have quite a large fan base in the Nordics, really.
Yeah, no, I mean, as I say, you know, I think a lot of product love out there, a lot of appreciation of craftsmanship. And I think that, you know, that's the sort of solid bedrock that led to where we got to in Sweden.
We just had a quick glance at your Instagram account just right before this, and it's when you had the first post on this celebration beer. Yeah. It was only like a lot of comments. Please send it to Sweden.
Please send it to Sweden.
It was like 10 of them directly. Yeah. It was quite funny to read. Of course, your core range is where the volume is, but I mean, you have these limited editions. Are the limited editions only happening by coincidence, or do they always have a plan with these limited editions?
No, I mean, I think the way that the business is now, you know, we need to be well planned out, particularly when we're looking at supply chains that expand across multiple territories and, you know, mm-hmm. into Sweden and things. So, no, I mean, we're very deliberate about our limiteds. We don't do too many of them. We try to do things that the consumer wouldn't expect us to do. Or would be, sorry, that's not the right way of saying it. They would probably, we want to do things that the consumer's delighted that we've done, but maybe didn't think about it. A perfect example of that is that the collaboration we've done with the Laphroaig, the famed Isle of Malt whiskey brand, single malt whiskey brand. Two pioneering Scottish companies come together, they've made a beer matured in Isle of whiskey barrels. That we've done that together, and I think that, you know, it's one of these beers that you try and you go, oh my god, there's a hell of a lot going on here.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you leave it in the glass, and the product changes. The smokiness leaves, and the different flavors come and go through the drinking experience. It's a drinking experience. You know, if you're not into smoky whiskey, it's probably not for you, but my god, if you like that sort of smoke or peaty kind of character, that's an amazing drinking experience. Same with products like Vanishing Point. You know, this year it'll be matured in famous Glenlivet single malt Scotch whiskey barrels, either 15 or 18 year olds, I can't remember. So a brilliant barrel to put there. To this imperial stout, and you know, it's a 12-month maturation, and again, it's a big drinking experience. Imperial stout is a big beer anyway, and then you layer in a 12-month in barrel maturation. It just takes you, or it adds all these layers of complexity and depth and character that make the product absolutely unique, a complete drinking experience, and that's so. It's got to kind of measure up. If we're going to do a limited edition, it needs to measure up to that criteria.
Yeah.
Which you'll understand, you know, you've got to think long and hard. So we have to be quite deliberate. Mm-hmm. And of course, this 20th anniversary edition that we're launching in August this month. Maturing the original, the beer that started it all, in 20-year-old single malt whiskey casks. I mean, what more fitting a way to celebrate?
I agree.
So it's the same ground beer that you're using for the celebration beer.
Yeah.
But compared to the previous experiment where you actually started on bourbon barrels, now you move over to 20-year-old used whiskey barrels.
Correct. Single malt whiskey cask, yeah.
Yeah.
And you also had another product that will be launched in Sweden, I think in August.
In August as well.
Yeah, the Cherry Creek product with some kind of local cherries.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was driving home from the brewery one night and I stopped at a fruit shop, which they tend to spring up all over Scotland by the road. in the summer months, and I stopped and I was going to buy some strawberries, and the lady behind the counter said, "Would you like to try some cherries?" And I said, "Well, okay." So I tried a cherry, and I said, "Bloody hell, that's really nice. Where are you growing these then?" And she sort of pointed down the hill and said, "In these polytunnels here." I said, "Bloody hell." I said, "I'll tell you what then, I'll take 3 punnets of strawberries and I'll have 2 tons of cherries." And she sort of panicked and said, I can't give you all at once, you know. So we worked out a way to do it. So I took my strawberries home and I spoke to Bruno and said, "Look, I think we should do a beer with cherries in it, because, you know, unbeknownst to me, there's a place in Scotland making cherries here." that was just a bit of fun. But again, it's a very unusual drinking experience it's a lovely drinking experience, but it's unusual because we're using Scottish cherries, not something you can find easily. We're bringing our barrel aging sort of history to it, and the way that we've manufactured the product. So it gives you a sort of unusual take on Creek, which is a very famed Belgian style. But we've obviously kind of innocent gunned it, put it through our lens, and it's come out like that. So yeah, it's a great beer. I hope you enjoy it when you try it. It's a cracker.
Yeah, you should really try to get hold of that one.
Yeah, but is it the first release of it this year, or have you done it before?
No, we've done it before. We've done it at least once before, maybe twice.
Yeah, because the one that's coming out now is, I think it's labeled 2023. So that's what I thought. Maybe this is something you have done before. So it's a re-release of the previous product.
Yeah, no, it is. We definitely had it in Sweden last year, but we didn't sell. I don't think we sent much. And our limiteds, you know, our seasonal releases do tend to sell out pretty quickly. So I don't think it was around very long.
No.
I think the Cherry Creek is sort of branded as a sour beer here on Systembolaget. Yeah. Is that true to the nature of the beer?
Yeah, you know, caveated by saying I absolutely hate sour beers. So it's always an absolute battle whenever the brewer suggests doing anything with a pH of less than 4. But they convinced me. So we did a kettle sour version of it. And actually, the thing about the cherries that they grow in Scotland, they're sweet cherries. They're not tart in any way at all. So actually, you needed a little bit of acidity just to balance out the sweetness of the cherries. So that's the only way I was prepared to brew anything with a pH of less than 4 was in this way. So don't expect a sour beer from Innocent Gun apart from this anytime soon.
That fits us quite well.
Yeah,
we're not that into sours.
Not that much into
sours. We haven't learned it yet.
No. But you can appreciate the craft, and it's certainly interesting, like domain and topic to explore and learn more about. And it's really a craft, and it's completely left to the nature to make its work normally.
Yeah. Look, I mean, there's a great craft that sits behind making sour beers. So I'm not running it down. It's just not for us. And on a personal note, I'm always worried that these sour beers are going to dissolve my teeth, you know, and I think that's becomes a bigger concern the older you get. You know?
Yeah. It would be bad.
Yeah. Sure. So do we have something more from our research you want?
We can probably talk forever.
Yeah, probably.
But one thing that we sort of discussed a little bit, since you're having sort of pretty big volumes nowadays, and you mature a lot of the beer on casks that is sort of limited in volume. So how do you solve that, the increasing demand on casks and used casks?
What we do is we buy the whiskey barrels, we break them up into lumps, and then we either put them in an oven or a pressure cooker. I'm just telling you the process. And what those different either heat or heat and pressure processes do is they accentuate the signature flavor characteristics of the wood that we want to extract. Then we take all those barrel pieces and we make a blend depending on the beer that we're making, and we put them into a vessel. We circulate fermented beer through that. So with original, we've got a specific blend of different heat and pressure barrel pieces that we circulate the beer through for 3 days. That extracts all of the flavor that we need, all the aroma, the signature, you know, the vanilla, the toffee, mm-hmm. orange sort of citrusy character. That all comes out in that process. Now we mature it in tank for a set period. For those, all the different flavors to sort of blend through right throughout the tank. We filter it and then we bottle it. And then when we bottle it, it needs another month for all the flavors just to sort of come into harmony. And then we release it. So that's the process. And in that way, we've been able to scale because we'd be using a hell of a lot of whiskey barrels now. And you know, I think the one thing that growing a barrel aged beer taught me was that actually repeatability is the hardest thing when you're using barrels every day. You know, you're filling beer into a barrel.
Yeah,
you never get consistency. And I think for a brand like Original, it needs to be consistent for people. You know, if you love the flavor, you can't have one batch that tastes of vanilla and another batch that tastes only of toffee. Drinkers are just not up for that. Yeah. You know, all the best brands are the most consistent. And so, you know, born out of a need, well, I actually ran out of barrels, or we ran out of barrel availability back in 2010. So we had to start developing a way around that. And then a need for absolute consistency. Yeah. We developed that process, and it's proprietary. I mean, we developed it. We own the technology, the machinery that sits behind it, you know, all the different pressure and temperature recipes that we treat the barrel pieces with. It's all proprietary tech, but that's how we do it. You know, we still put beer into barrel. Yeah. You know, all of our limiteds pretty much go in a barrel. You know, we still do some pretty long barrel maturations, but you know, for things like Original and Caribbean Rum Cask, that's the way we do it. And that's the way we scale it.
So the anniversary beer, is that going through the same process, or is that actually also barrel?
No, that's in a barrel.
That's in a real barrel.
We filled that into single malt whiskey casks. We've matured it up in we've got a small brewery in Perth, which is about an hour north of Edinburgh. And then obviously we've emptied that. And then it goes through the same process. You know, it sits in a tank for a set period. We bottle it and we have to leave that for a set period, and then it's ready to sell. So there's bits of the process are the same either way. But that for the 20th limited edition, it's all been in a barrel in the warehouse in Perth, Scotland.
Yeah. Cool. I think we're pretty much up on the hour.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe we can probably talk a bunch more on different beer styles, and we have all the beers sitting in front of us here, just sort of inspiration. So we can go through each and every one and discuss the flavors and the brands and everything. But that's maybe something for another time.
Yeah.
Because we're a little short on time now. But I think we are very, very happy to have you on this podcast, talking about Innocent Gun and the history and the future of the brand, and also the stuff coming up with the 20th anniversary. So we will thank you very much to take your time and join us here today.
Well, it's been very nice to meet you both. I love talking about beers, you can probably tell. So
we noticed.
It's a privilege, you know what I mean? And, you know, maybe next time I'm out, you know, we can get together and taste through some of the beers and continue the conversation. I've really, really enjoyed chatting to you, and I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk.
That would be lovely.
Do that and do maybe some more tasting sessions. We talked about that today, but today is lunchtime in the middle of the work week. So we thought maybe it's a bad idea. So maybe do it.
Yeah, keep it sensible until the weekend. It's only Tuesday.
Yeah. True.
Well, super fun to talk to you.
Take
care and good luck with the future and everything.
Thank you. And thank you for your kind feedback on the beers too. I really appreciate it.
Yep.
Well deserved. Thank you so much, Dougal.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
Cheers.
Cheers.